8:37 a.m. on the 10th of April 2014. We have members present: Representative Holmes, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Costello, Stoltz, Co-Chair Osterman, Representative T. Wilson, Representative Edgman, Representative Thompson, and Vice Chair Newman. We have three measures before us today. We have House Bill 121, which has been before us a couple of times, the CFAB legislation, Senate Bill 56, which we heard last year. We're going to have a couple of presentations and put some issues on the table, and then House Bill 160, the athletic trainers. But we'll first take up 121, so Mr. Pascal can get on and do better and more important things. We have a committee substitute before us. One minor change. It replaces the previous committee substitute with the language regarding loan qualifications. Takes a much softer touch. I don't believe it was allocative, but folks supporting this bill and the commercial fishing industry and the out-of-state folks went ballistic. And you know, I think they're wrong, but we backed off and. We can't get a sport fish or a personal use issue held anywhere else, so that was our frustration, Representative Newman and I and some others, but no apologies, but just an explanation. So we have some very soft language that they have to look at, just the conservation and the health, and it mirrors language that you'll recognize from the Alaska State Constitution about sustainability. Representative Newman, would you like to move the CS?
Mr. Chair, I move committee substitute for House Bill number 121, Finance, version /O, dated 4/4/14, for committee referral.
Objection, Mr. Chair. Actually, I had a couple of amendments. I don't know if they've been discussed.
Well, Representative Guerra, we can take your amendments if you approve the CS.
Oh.
We have to have a document.
Sorry. yep. That's fine.
So is there any objection?
No objection.
Well, objection to hear the changes.
I just basically gave the change. I described the changes on page 5, section 2. So hearing no objection, the CS is before us. I guess we'll go right to Representative Guerra. Do you have amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Move amendment number 1.
Let's see. I had that one before me.
Yes. No.
I had those last night. I might have had them on my desk. So. Will you speak to your amendment? There is an objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, in a very big way, expands the ability of CFAB to loan to businesses owned by persons and corporations who are not Alaskans. Much of CFAB's activity has been related to in-state owned businesses, but now it's expanded to out-of-state owned fisheries companies, out-of-state owned mining activity, out-of-state owned tourism companies. And so in the tourism example, I know, for example, that in you know, throughout Alaska, there have been attempts by locals to, for example, start fishing lodges. But if you look at, I think, a huge number of the fishing lodges, they're owned by out-of-staters. Those folks come up for a few months and then they leave. They hire out-of-staters, they stay for a few months and they leave. And so what Amendment Number 1 does is it just gives the CFAB board the ability to make the determination whether the loan's going to displace a business that's being planned by or that exists that's owned by Alaskans. I don't want the money to be used to displace Alaskan-owned businesses. And I think CFAB can make that determination, and that's Amendment Number 1.
And Mr. Pascal, we're going to go directly to Mr. Klingert. Ms. Klingert, instead of you, would you? Ms. Klingert in Anchorage?
Hello?
Yes. Did you hear the amendment described? And please give your comments as the administrator of the bank.
I would ask
if he could repeat that, because I'm not sure I understood exactly what the amendment.
I'm not going to ask him to repeat the whole diatribe, but the amendment. Do not describe it. Just please state your amendment, Representative Guerra.
Hold your mic, so he can hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment would say that before making a loan under the section, the board must find that the loan will not result in the displacement of an existing or planned Alaska-owned business. And that's just to address the new sections on non-Alaskan businesses.
That seems very, very clear. Do you have a comment, Ms. Klingert?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that my first comment would be that in the actual credit process, the board generally does not get involved in those decisions. The board only meets roughly five times a year, so from a board standpoint, that would severely hamper it. From a second position, I'm not really sure how we could determine that.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Will the clerk call the roll?
Wait a minute.
I asked if there were questions, Representative Holmes.
I was trying to make sure that Representative Munoz knew which bill we were on, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that I like the intent of this, but I just don't think it's a workable standard that the bank has to find that the loan will not result in the displacement of existing or planned Alaskan-owned business. I just don't. I like the intent, but I just don't see how any bank could ever make that finding. So I'm going to have to vote against the amendment.
Any other comments? Representative Newman?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to state quite a few of the lodges up and down the Susitna River, Yetna River now, are owned by not just out of state, but out of country. It's become more of a trend, I think, to have that done. And I like the amendment that we keep this stuff for Alaskans. And I think that was the original intent because it falls under Alaska statute, and it's not a standard open bank. It's supported under Alaska statute, and I think that was the original intent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other? Representative Newman. I'm Representative Thompson. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I like the intent also, but I find it kind of hard to figure out how they could a planned Alaska-owned business. They could have a company come in, go through the applications, the scrutiny, come back and approve the loan, and then suddenly a week later somebody comes in and said, I've been planning on doing this. I mean, how do you figure out who's planned Alaska-owned business? I don't see how they can figure out how that works.
Any other? Would you like any closing, Representative?
Mr. Chair, I would just move an amendment to the amendment to strike out the words or planned, because I think we were struggling with that, and I think Representative Thompson is right. So existing business, we know, or planned, they're not going to be able to figure out probably.
Can you move that amendment? Does everybody understand that proposed amendment to the amendment? It just on line 5, it deletes the words or planned in between existing and Alaskan. Is there objection to that amendment to the amendment? So amendment number 1 as amended is before us. I believe there still is objection. Please call the roll.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Costello.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Guerra.
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Holmes.
No.
Representative Munoz.
No.
Representative Newman.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Osterman.
Yes.
Representative Stoltz.
Yes.
Representative Costello.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Nine yay, 2 nay.
So by a vote of 9 yay, 2 nay, the amendment number 1 as amendment passes. I think Representative Guerra is near his quota. Do you want to keep going?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe in quotas.
That was levity.
So, though I have saved the bypassing that, we're not going to need to touch amendment number 3. So, if that saves folks time or makes anybody happy, I just have one more amendment. I move amendment number 2, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I really don't even want to go close to the debate we had yesterday. We have a statute on the books that says board members are supposed to be Alaskans. And but we heard testimony, board members on state boards are supposed to be Alaskans. We heard testimony where people call this almost a private bank, that it had original seed money. I believe it's a state bank personally. It had original seed money, but since then it's been essentially acting as what one testifier called something like an almost private bank. And I just want to make sure that there's no ambiguity. I believe that this statute already applies to CFAB, that board members should be residents of the state, but I just want to clarify that just in case somebody tries to argue that CFAB is not really a state entity. So that's the only purpose.
Ms. Klinger, would you prefer Ms. Klinger to respond, Mr. Pascoe, or you?
That's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm trying to give you a deference.
For the record, Michael Pascoe, staff representative, FIGI, I believe that the bank president can respond appropriately. I believe the bank president can respond appropriately to this.
Okay. Okay, Ms. Klingert.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Guerra. I don't think there's really an issue with that, with the exception of that the membership. A lot of when we make the loans, like anything, people are definitely residents. We adhere to the statute, but when they and they still retain their membership, but we have no control over them moving out of state after the fact. So, given that as a co-op, you are entitled, or I believe it's appropriate that the members be able to elect those that represent them. That having that restriction may cause them not to have the selection that they would choose, and that they would be aware of where they were living at the time. They may still be members, but they may not still be residents, even though they were at the time. And so that would impair, you know, the owners, the members of the co-op, is their choice of representation.
Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Klinger, this has nothing to do with the membership. It has everything to do with the board itself. So if this was part of the statutes that ran your business, it would be just plain and simple to the membership that the only board member you can elect is an Alaskan. Is that it doesn't seem like it's a very complicated issue.
And Ms. Klinger, a follow-up on that, a lot of the fishermen I've talked to said, we moved to Seattle. They said, we're still Alaskan in our hearts. And that's the language that's used. And with how they've rationalized this expansion, along with Representative Feige in sponsoring the bill, is, well, we're real Alaskans in our hearts, and we come up here. We spend more time up here exploiting the resources than we do at home sometimes if they're in multiple gear types. And I see nodding around the table from folks in the industry that they might be from Bristol Bay. They've moved to Seattle. They might be from Hoonah or Juneau. They moved to Seattle. That's the nature of that commercial fishing industry. Folks move out of state. Is that what you're expressing along with the advocates of this bill, Ms. Klingert?
Chairman Stoltz.
You don't have to take all my words, but just the fact that many permit holders are now do reside in Seattle or other places outside Alaska.
I would say that there is that happens when people are fishing, you know, here, and for whatever reason move outside, their residency changes, yes. I'd say that's a correct statement.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems clear that what's important is at the time of the appointment. After that, you know, what they do is something else, but it's at the time of the appointment. That seems pretty clear and simple.
Okay. I came in here with an I came in here actually thinking I was probably going to vote against this, but I've been talking to the commercial fishermen on the committee that I think this isn't deleterious to it. I don't know. That's
this isn't.
Yeah. Representative Osterman.
Mr. Chairman, this doesn't just apply to commercial fishermen. This applies to everybody.
I understand.
Bank loans money too. So I'm kind of, you know, I hope you would center on what the issue is rather than getting into other areas of.
I was only sharing the anecdotes that have been shared with me.
Yeah, well, in Kodiak, I've got a lot of sport fishermen that run lodges, that live in Guam, that live in Florida, that live everywhere else out in the world. They have the same option to them as this bank, get a loan. So I don't understand why we need to continue to roll back to your fixation on the commercial side of it.
Yeah, I'm against those guys in Guam, too. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question for the sponsor of the amendment, would the intent be that board members be Alaska residents? I'm assuming that there's term limits on these board memberships. If they were to move outside the state of Alaska when they were to be reappointed again, if they were not Alaska residents, then they would not be eligible for reappointment to the board.
How does that work, Ms. Klingert?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the terms are 3 years for the board that is elected by the membership, and then we do have two board members that are appointed by the governor, and their terms are also 3 years.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, Ms. Klingert, are these, or maybe somebody, I don't know the sponsor, are these board members subject to legislative approval?
I can answer that through the chair, Mr. Representative Newman. They are not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then it's my assumption it wouldn't be such a big deal if they're not, don't have to come up for legislative approval. If they move out of state, then they just would not be, you know, my assumption would be that they would not be eligible for reappointment, and they would just move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you tell me what the current requirements are for board membership and how many of your board members are Alaskan residents currently?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Munoz. The requirement for board membership for all but the ones that are appointed by the governor, those two, and then one is required by statute to be a farmer, and then the remaining directors, the requirement is simply that they must be a member of the bank and must not be involved in any type of litigation with the bank.
And do you have any non-resident members of your board currently?
I apologize. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, to my knowledge, we do not.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman and then Thompson? No. Any other questions from anybody? Representative Guerra, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I think the discussion's been good. Whether somebody ceased to be an Alaska resident after they were appointed, I don't want the law is not going to be interpreted any differently than the law that already exists for all the other boards. So I believe that law is interpreted, though probably people slip through the cracks, I think that law is interpreted to mean that you have to be Alaska resident. If you're not anymore, you lose your eligibility. That probably doesn't get enforced. But the interpretation of this will be not what I say, it's how the existing statute has always been interpreted. So we're just putting the existing statute that requires that you be an Alaska resident in here. We believe it probably already applies, but we just want to make sure.
Are there any other questions? Is objection to Amendment Number 2 maintained? Is there any objection to Amendment Number 2? Mm-hmm. Hearing none, Amendment Number 2 is adopted. Do we have any other amendments?
No. Not for me.
Okay. There are some other people on the committee, too.
Yeah.
So, to the fiscal notes, Representative Costello.
Mr. Cochin, there's one fiscal note for House Bill 121 from Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, OMB, component number 2808. It shows a fiscal impact in FY15 of zero, and then in FY16, $5,700, and then in FY19, $5,700, and that is for travel. There's a change in revenue in FY16 of $23,500, and a change in revenue in FY19 of $23,500, and this is dated January 15th, 2014.
Any questions on the fiscal notes? Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, I would move committee substitute for House Bill number 121, Finance, version /O, dated 4/4/14, from committee, as amended, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Hearing none. Appreciate the patience of your office as we got through this, Mr. Pascal. Godspeed on the rest of the travels. We'll take just about a 30-second at ease and let the sponsor of the next bill get forward. We have before us Senate Bill 56, briefly heard last year toward the end of the session, back before us. And I'd like to announce the crime bill, which we're trying to have these travel together, is not in our possession. We will try to deal with all our crime bills together. So this will be the first presentation on this bill. So Senator Dyson and Mr. Kopp, welcome.
Thank you. It was almost a year ago to the day that we sat here with this, and the chairman promised we'd get it back up and deal with it, and I appreciate that. This bill is driven by two or three things. Most of our drug laws were put in place by 1982, and the dealing with them and looking at them and revising them has seldom happened in the intervening period. And as you all know, I'm sure that much of the nation now, states are reevaluating their classification and sentencing criteria. Some of it, or most of it, driven by costs. And we are incarcerating people in our state at amongst the highest, five or six highest in the nation. And it's really driving the cost of incarceration. And you'll see in your packet graphs that show, having just spent $250 million on a prison, another 4 or 5 years, if we continue business as usual, we'll be needing to be building another one or something like it. And that's just got to be a huge issue. Second issue is when people have been incarcerated, most of them are going to get out and go back into society. And we're hoping with this take a small step to removing some of the barriers to reentry. There are, I'm told, something like 1,500 jobs and benefits you can't get with a felony conviction, and maybe half of those in our state, a startling number to me. And so that allows the person who is busted to get back into society if they cleaned up their act, and we're seeing that our drug treatment is surprisingly effective in our system. So that's the restorative justice here. And I, perhaps even more some of my lawyer friends here, take a very high view of the law. We create statute law when the people elect us and we come and make statutes, and we want them to state our values and that they be proportional and not easily look foolish. And it's our view that this one is one that's needed to be revised for a long, long time. So we're going to quickly go through here this slide presentation, and it's a significant improvement to last year, and I'm going to let Chuck, who most of you know was a 25-year police officer, highly decorated in our state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Fred Dyson. The balance of justice and proportionality in the law spoken of by the bill sponsor speaks to the punishment of an offender fitting the crime. Currently, we have before the committee about a dozen C felonies, so you can see what this level of offense is compared to others. And the point is, are these proportional harms? So the first one we have here that's a C felony is if a person possesses any amount of a Schedule 1A or a 2A drug. So the example here is 1 grain of a painkiller, like hydrocodone or cocaine or any drug you can think of that's a 1A or a 2A. If that is detectable in a narcotics test, that possession of that is a C felony. It's no defense that the amount of drug was not a usable quantity in our statute, only that it be positively identified. Moving down, you see that it's equivalent to putting someone in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. If I was to pull out a firearm and point it at the head of any person and threaten to kill them, even go further, pull it to the side of their head and discharge it into the wall just to let them know I was serious, that would also be a C felony. Stalking first degree is a C felony, and this is when a person engages in a course of conduct with a victim by following them, entering their property, or contacting them by phone, delivering them items, and placing them in fear of death and possessing a deadly weapon while you're doing it. Sexual assault third degree is a C felony, and that's where you have sexual contact with someone that you know is mentally incapable or incapacitated or otherwise unaware or unable to consent to the sex act. It's also a prison guard engaging in sexual penetration with a prisoner. Indecent exposure first degree is a C felony, and an example would be a person knowingly exposing their genitals to a child while masturbating. Vehicle theft first degree is stealing a police car or having no right to do so, stealing any motor vehicle, airplane, or boat of another person. Endangering the welfare of a vulnerable adult first degree is a C felony, and that's where a person without lawful excuse would fail to provide support for a vulnerable adult who is in your care by authority of law, and the vulnerable adult suffers serious physical injury. Promoting contraband first degree is also a Class C felony, if that's if you bring a firearm or drugs into a prison. Possession of child pornography is a Class C felony. Unlawful furnishing of explosives, that's if a person gives explosive to another person knowing that the person intends to use them to commit a crime. Sex trafficking third degree, a person with intent to promote prostitution manages, supervises, controls, or owns a place of prostitution. And then finally, cruelty to animals, where a person intentionally inflicts severe physical pain or prolonged suffering on an animal, or knowingly kills an animal with intent to intimidate or threaten another person. Those are all proportionally treated in our law. And the bill sponsor's purpose of showing that is to show, do we see those all as being equivalent harms? Have we over-criminalized simple possession? Going to the Class A misdemeanor offense, which is very pertinent to Senate Bill 56, because it would reclassify small quantity possession for first-time offenders to a misdemeanor. These are offenses that we already consider Class A misdemeanors. You get up to 1 year in prison and up to a $10,000 fine. The bill sponsor believes it is a serious charge and a penalty to be reckoned with. Assault in the fourth degree, which can include domestic violence assault, is a Class A misdemeanor. We give someone 2 arrests at driving under the influence, and we don't differentiate if that was a tractor trailer or your own vehicle. Driving under the influence is a very serious offense, and we let someone do that twice as a DUI, as long as there's no injury involved. Then it is a felony. But 2 times you're allowed at an A misdemeanor. Resisting or interfering with arrest, even by use of force, is a Class A misdemeanor. And official misconduct, where a public servant with intent to benefit or injure another does an unauthorized exercise of his official function. Those are some examples of Class A misdemeanors. So Senate Bill 56 simply introduces into the law a dosage matrix that we have not had there before to help us differentiate between traffickers, peddlers, and what we would call addicts, or people simply possessing, and we would acknowledge up front that not all people who possess are addicts. I think the drug data says about a third of the people who are caught for first-time possession are actually addicts, so we don't want to overstate that. But it does this by creating an escalating punishment system similar to the state's approach to DUIs, how we treat thefts, how we treat criminally negligent burning. That's where you damage someone's property by fire or explosion. The law now says you can do that twice on a misdemeanor level before your third time's a felony in 10 years. And assault. So we do that four other areas in our law where we use three strikes. We do that to give a person a chance for meaningful reform. If they screw up twice and fail to participate in their own rehabilitation, the next offense results in a felony charge. We establish strict quantity limits. Over the limit equals implied distribution, and you're a felon. We modeled Wyoming's law. They're a fairly conservative state, not exactly a bastion of liberalism. It's working well for them, and that's the example we followed. There are no restrictions placed on law enforcement or prosecutors to pursue drug manufacturing or selling. Any evidence of manufacturing or selling is treated just the same and is not touched by this bill. The bill sponsor believes, and our research shows, that it will lead to reduced incarceration costs, reduced legal adjudication costs, and low-risk offenders. Reduction in the numbers of low-risk offenders being placed on felony probation. Felony probation is very expensive. When you have low-risk people you're supervising, that's very expensive. And improving the opportunities for people to be employed when they get out of prison and participate in legitimate economies. And reduction in indirect costs, such as having people be on public assistance needing medical care, housing, and food that has to be provided for on public assistance because they're not employable. The Alaska prison population growth, this is a DOC slide. You've seen this many times before, their own projections, the red line showing the increase of the addition of Goose Creek, and the blue line being the prison population projected going up. You can see where they intersect here in a couple more years now. And where we'll be at capacity again. And we anticipate the next prison will be more than 250 million. So the drivers of the Alaska's prison population growth, the source was a Department of Corrections memo in 2012, identifying those as felony theft in the second degree, which is dealt with in the crime bill that you'll hear later, Senate Bill 64, a significant rise in prison admission for drug offenders, particularly felony offenders convicted of possession offenses, and an increase in petitions to revoke probation and probation violations. So those are kind of driving our growth in our prison. The Alaska court cases filed, the graph shows the number of misconduct involving controlled substance fourth degree charges in 2008, a little over 600, and in 2013, about 1,100. So going up considerably, almost double in that period. Now, not all of these are possession charges, but a third to a half are. Misconduct involving controlled substance fourth degree involves several subsets of charges. Collateral consequences from small quantities, drug possession felonies. Again, looking at how do we increase the number of work, education, business opportunities, and volunteerism that people can get into to prevent recidivism, as stated by Senator Coghill. We do know that Alaska ranks number one in the nation for state-created legislative and regulatory barriers to successful reentry for individuals with a criminal record. This is according to the National Legal Action Council and the National Collateral Consequences of Conviction Board, both of them cited. Deborah Perriman with the Alaska Justice Forum wrote this most recent article with the UA Justice Center. Offenders who complete their sentences seldom, if ever, stop paying for their crimes. And we know that barriers to reentry into society affect a lot of Alaskans. In 1982, there was one out of 90 Alaskans in the custody of our correction system in some way or another. Today, we're just one over 30-something. So we have a lot more people now under supervision. We see the barriers listed with the employers, whether it be school district or the private sector in the oil and gas industry, difficulty to find housing, restrictions on ability to adopt or receive placement of foster children, inability to qualify for public assistance benefits on release from prison, ineligible to become a BPSO, all of these consequences. So SB 56 will help Alaskans avoid many of these consequences if they meaningfully participate in their own reform and they're not repeat offenders. We do have a treatment amendment that came in House Judiciary where someone is referred to treatment if they are to be charged as a first-time offender, and that treatment amendment is in Section 3 of the bill, where they are required to satisfy the screening, evaluation, referral, and program requirements of a drug abuse evaluation program. This shows the reduced legal and adjudication costs between felonies and misdemeanor cases in district and superior court. This shows both the mean and the median number of days if you're a felon or a misdemeanant. The courts have, in their fiscal notes, have said that this will save the system money. It's hard to quantify exactly how much, but superior court judges cost more. Grand juries cost lots of money to impanel, witness testimony. And when you're tried with a felony because of the great risk of spending more than a year in prison, you're afforded a higher level of legal counsel and you get a higher quality lawyer, someone who has had more training to represent you. So there is more costs in those. So we consider this a fiscally conservative policy. Legislative Research Service and estimates that up to $14 million in annual cost savings will come majority from Department of Corrections. The Office of Public Advocacy fiscal note estimates about $250,000 a year in savings based on this most recent year, and they get that savings of $1,100 a case at 255 cases that were similar to what we would be reclassifying. The Public Defender Agency's fiscal note does say it will reduce the cost of processing individual cases and will reduce the overall cost growth rate of the agency's budget. The Department of Corrections fiscal note said in 2012 there were 427 mixed four convictions, which carried an average length of stay of 188 days. The department could see a potential reduction in man days of 54,186 days. Well, we know prison is $150 a day, so that's $8 million, but that is, again, that's a guess, and everybody knows that probably less than half of those convictions would actually be impacted by this bill. So even if we said less than half and we're around $4 million, the bill sponsor believes there would be a savings. The Department of Law fiscal note says the fiscal note is indeterminate, but generally reducing an offense from a felony to a misdemeanor creates a savings in the criminal justice system. The Alaska State Troopers fiscal note says passage of this bill will not change the investigative process regarding these offenses and will have no fiscal impact on the Division of State Troopers. And the laboratory of DPS similarly has zero fiscal note. So on the public safety impacts, 13 states have reclassified some Schedule 1 and 2A drugs from felony to misdemeanor possession. There was some discussion last year about, well, what states are actually really similar? There are 10 states that have reclassified heroin, methamphetamine, and cocaine, small quantities, to misdemeanor for first time. Three states did cocaine, and those would be Mississippi and Wyoming. I'm sorry, got them here. Maine, Wisconsin, and Mississippi. Mississippi is prosecutorial discretion only whether you're charged with a felon or misdemeanor, but 13 states have gone through this. Looking at the data of those states, Alaska's adult incarceration rate is 537 per 100,000. And the average adult incarceration rate of the 13 states that have done this is 490. So not that much less, but about 47 less per 100,000. Five of these states do have a higher adult incarceration rate per 100,000. I see them listed there. Mississippi is an outlier. Their incarceration rate is so high, it really pulls up the average. They incarcerate the second highest in the nation at just under 1,000 per 100,000. The eight states that have a lower adult incarceration rate in Alaska are also listed there, and they have a 381 per 100,000 average. So looking at the chart here, it shows where Alaska is at. The blue column shows our violent crime rate. The green column, our property crime rate, and the purple one, the incarceration rate. So Alaska compared to the reclassification states grouped together would show that the violent crime rate of those states is less, and the property crime rate is somewhat less, and the incarceration rate is very similar. Now, compared to all the states, you can see that Alaska still has a significantly higher violent crime rate. All the states' average is actually higher on the property crime than Alaska's, and our incarceration rate averages are very close. When you look at just the 10 states that have, in fact, reclassified heroin, cocaine, and meth to first-time small quantity possession misdemeanor, you can see, again, very similar. The violent crime rate in Alaska is still higher compared to those states that have done that. The property crime rates are similar, and the incarceration rates are a little bit less in the states that have reclassified. So that is basically to say that it's tough to draw causal inferences that public safety is substantially hurt by going through this reclassification. Looking at those states, the data does not show strongly, we feel, one way or the other, that there's an impact to public safety. And just in conclusion, the Wall Street Journal recently had an article by Mark Kleiman, Rethinking the War on Drugs, stating the U.S. has reached a dead end in trying to fight drug use by treating every offender as a serious criminal. And while blanket drug legalization has some superficial charm, fits nicely into a soundbite or tweet, it can't stand up to serious analysis. The real prospects for reform involve policies rather than slogans. It remains to be seen whether our political process and the media circus that often shapes it can tolerate the necessary complexity. And Bill's sponsor found another great quote. For every complex problem, H.L. Mencken wrote, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong. The probable outcomes we're looking at seeking is a balance of justice and proportionality, which the bill sponsor spoke to, a large reduction in the barriers to reentry for offenders, improvement in employability, more persons successfully restored to a healthy lifestyle, a minimal impact on public safety, significant fiscal savings, and following the example of another state that's had good results. Some examples of some entities and organizations that have supported this effort, and we thank you.
Thank you. We're just about out of the time that the chairman gave me. Let me tell you, this bill, this classification, there's no evidence for these people to get busted under it that they're users, although many of them may be. No evidence of redistribution, and no evidence that they are under the influence of the time. I have in my hand here, I've had several surgeries later, this is a bottle of oxycodone acetamine, and I have three bottles. I brought this one because the prescription has expired. It's a 2011. If I'd have brought one of the other ones, but if I had an oxycodone pill in here, which I did till recently, you could bust me for it. And I'll bet you could take this and find some residue in there, and I would be guilty. And in your packet, there'll be a article from the, I think, the Daily Disappointment, of a professional person who got busted for that very thing, a prescription bottle that was expired that had residue in it, and he said it ruined his life. And so please don't think anything we're doing here is to be soft on crime, but it is indeed to get proportionality. I was impressed by the list that was up there of all the Class C felonies that are equivalent to this one in the law, you know, and it's just bizarre. And so we're glad to take a few minutes to answer questions, but we're about out of the time allowed.
I would like, with the names redacted, if that case could be given to Ms. Carpinetti and she can tell us the details, then we won't be dealing with an anecdote. Is that something we can do?
Sure, and okay. I too don't trust everything that's in the paper.
So, and that's one that's been used at all the committee hearings, and And that's one. If there aren't other circumstances, and everything's that's a shocking incident.
Yep.
Often there's a different there's a little Paul Harvey as well. The rest of the story. So, we have about 5 minutes or so, and we're going to be back. You're both. We'll have both of you back, and today we're going to have some other presentations by some folks that are here to do similar short. Laying some issues out on the table. So I don't see any questions. We will have you back, and I know this is an issue you have
passion, a lot of work into it, and you're not shy about talking to people.
Thank you.
Thank you both. I would like to, there's one individual here that hasn't participated in the past. There's somebody from the Juneau Police Department representing their professional organization, the Peace Officers Association. Welcome. Did I describe that capacity correctly?
You did.
Okay. Please. I just saw the name. I didn't know. I didn't know if you're male or female.
Yes, I'm
clear now.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm Lieutenant Chris Sell. My mother calls me Christy. And I am a lieutenant with the Juneau Police Department, but that's not the capacity that brings me here today, though I do supervise the drug unit there. I'm the state vice president of the Alaska Peace Officers Association. As part of that organization and that board, I represent approximately 900 current and retired police officers from the state of Alaska. And the board, by consensus, does not support this bill. We don't think that this bill is on the right track. We know from our real life experience that small quantities are dealer quantities. Dealers aren't carrying around bags of drugs and selling bits of them, and then we can, you know, have them with these large quantities and automatically move them into felonies. Dealers are usually carrying points, which is a tenth of a gram. It's a tiny, tiny amount of drugs. So we know that this bill is a Christmas present for drug dealers. And we tend to not want to give them Christmas presents. We would rather they stop dealing drugs. So we are against this bill. We know that this would be a great benefit to dealers. It would give them more bites of the apple, more chances to involve more people in the drug world. I understand the intent that the person who's curious or makes a mistake and you're not wanting to hammer those people, and we understand that, and we quite frankly don't see those people doing large amounts of jail time. But the people that we're really talking about in our experience are the drug dealers. And this is, I'm not saying that our current system is perfect. I think we all know that treatment and accountability are large components of dealing with getting somebody off drugs. But I've heard some things from the Department of Law about their stance on this, and of course I agree with that. Some of the pleas that could come for post-conviction relief from professional drug dealers who have pled out to this charge and now sure wish they had a misdemeanor and are now going to be wanting that. It's people back out on the street that we've seen tear families apart, be behind burglaries that leave people feeling so violated, or taking credit cards and checkbooks and devastating the lives. You want to talk about having your life ruined. A drug dealer stealing your identity to fund a habit will definitely do that. So I ask you to consider the possibility of not being among the states that goes softest on hard drugs. The Peace Officers Association would ask you to consider this as not being the path we want to take. Thank you.
Do you have a written position statement?
I don't. I did not do a written position statement.
Is it a part? It'd be nice to have.
We do have a letter that we sent to the sponsor early on.
I don't have that in the packet.
Okay. I guess it's in the packet.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really have the same question I could ask either the Department of Law or the current witness. I just don't know if the Department of Law is going to testify.
Yeah, we're going to have both public safety and law up.
I can't wait. Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And if you're available again, we know how to get hold of you, I assume.
911.
Yeah, we don't have a sense of humor in this committee. I would like Mr. Folger and I believe Ms. Howell or whoever, your team, our public safety team. That's how we'll describe that testifying group.
Thank you.
And if the other gentleman wishes to join, unless he's been told to stay back. Okay. This is an all-points bulletin here. Welcome.
Morning.
This is here for your statements. It would seem odd to deal with a drug bill without talking to public safety.
Morning, members. I sit back here.
Put yourself on the record.
My first name is Gary. Last name is Folger, Commissioner of Public Safety. Thinking back, a couple things of law enforcement really, truly, one of the things on the table is they hate the way things are, and then they hate the change. And so when I first looked at this bill, there is definitely some changes, and foreseen or unforeseen consequences from it is something that we don't really know about, maybe, but we can guess at it. And so I've asked Ms. Howell to share some of our concerns. So.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to Commissioner Designee Gary Folger. If it pleases the committee, what I'd like to do is just read from a prepared statement that we have that outlines some of our concerns with Senate Bill 56.
And you'll provide that to us as well?
Absolutely, sir.
Thanks.
There's no doubt that substance abuse is a significant contributor to crime in Alaska. Yet even given the statement, we acknowledge that possession of small quantities of certain Schedule 1A or 2A substances for a first-time offender is more proportional to misdemeanor rather than felony behavior. The expectation is that a misdemeanor penalty for a first offense can serve as a wake-up call and potentially deter offenders from future drug offenses or other crimes. Whether the same philosophy should apply to a second-time offender is a matter we ask the legislature to take under further consideration. Subsequently, we also encourage additional deliberation on the quantities identified as non-distributive or small quantity amounts as proposed in Senate Bill 56. The Alaska State Troopers Statewide Drug Enforcement Unit reports that an average per use of heroin is approximately 1.1 or 1/10 of a gram. That's 100 milligrams. Page 3, lines 12 and 13 of the bill, I believe, provide for a quantity of 500 milligrams. So this would equate to approximately five uses, and is whether that's considered a user level versus a distribution level, again, is a matter for the body to consider. Similarly, an average per use of methamphetamine is 0.75 to 1.0 grams. In 3 grams, 3 grams of methamphetamine, which is included in the bill, would be about 3 to 4 uses. Though these could be considered user level quantities, again, we urge close scrutiny of these levels to avoid a potential unintended consequence of empowering street level distributors, as Lieutenant Sell testified to. Another issue relates to the 300 milligram threshold established for LSD. That's on page 3, lines 14 and 15 of the bill. The Statewide Drug Enforcement Unit reports that they rarely encounter LSD in a measurable form. It's usually found in dosage units, with some of the liquid having been absorbed into a more solid form, such as blotter paper, sugar cubes, or gelatin. The actual potency level of each dosage unit can range from 30 to 100 micrograms. That's 1/1,000,000th of a gram, if I've got that right. Therefore, the threshold amount that's currently proposed in Senate Bill 56 equals approximately 300 doses. The minimum threshold established by this bill will have an impact on the workload of the Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory within the Department of Public Safety. The way that it will impact it is it will require testing of enough of the substance to meet the threshold under the bill. For example, whereas currently the lab may need to positively identify one tablet to determine whether it was a prohibited substance under the law, analysis of at least 15 tablets, if present, may now need to be done to meet the threshold and the burden of proof. So though it will impact the workload, our Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory has indicated that they will attempt to manage this increase in workload within its current staffing. So in closing, We must be careful and thoughtful to ensure a balanced approach to protect the public from dangerous offenders while holding offenders accountable at the appropriate levels, whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. We do believe this is a worthy effort, and the Department of Public Safety will continue to work with the legislature on this issue. Thank you.
So if we were to characterize your position, you don't have a green light, you don't have a red light, you have a pretty strong flashing amber here?
That would be a fair statement, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Questions? Mr. Guerra?
Yeah, just well, no, it's off point, so no.
It's never stopped you before.
You have no idea how many times it stopped me.
Representative Gettenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking about the crime lab, increased crime lab work, and you were talking about, if I heard correctly, measuring not just one pill, but every pill, and you know, if somebody has a bag full of, but aren't we talking about an aggregate amount? I mean, you just, you know, just thinking about the workload, you just put it all into one sample and test it. That would be simply the most appropriate way to deal with something. You wouldn't have to worry about a single dosage one at a time. You would just measure an aggregate amount. Is that the way this bill reads?
Through the chair, Representative.
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, excuse me. Terry Vrabeck, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Public Safety. Ms. Howell explained, right now, if I got caught for possession of a substance, you're going to take a small portion of that and test it. That's all we need for the evidence level. But now, if we raise that to that certain amount, where we explained it would be like five doses, five hits of that substance, we would have to test all of that. So it is going to... they'll have to test each of those, and it just takes time. It's just more time and effort for the crime lab, and that would be for any of the substances. They would just have they'd be just testing more. Right now, like I said, we just test a small portion of it. It means that we do not test it all. We, you know, it's evidence. We keep it, of course, but we're not testing it all.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's my understanding then, if somebody gets caught with drugs, you don't take and have a measurable amount, so that when you go to prosecution, you could tell the judge they had this amount of quantity. You just say they had it, and they don't. You don't measure the quantity.
Through the chair, we would obviously have a weight, and that would be in evidence again. But we are not necessarily testing the whole amount. So if I had a pound of cocaine right now, it's going to say, you know, I have a pound of cocaine. But have we tested the whole pound? No. That answer your question, Representative?
Well, through the chair, I don't know how a pound of cocaine looks besides what I may be seeing on TV. But if you would test a portion of that and it was all contained in the same, you would still measure that amount. We're talking about some small, I think Senator Dyson was talking about some prescription drugs or something like that, in small amounts. You wouldn't measure the quantity in a small amount that they had total?
Can I attend to
go
that?
Ahead.
Okay, Representative Newman, through the chair. To give you an example, on page 3, starting on line 2, it does indicate 15 or more tablets. So just as an example, if someone had 3 tablets and we test one of those tablets and determine that it's a substance prohibited under the bill, then they would be underneath that, the limit established. Let's say that it's oxycodone. If they had 15 or more tablets, that could potentially be the raise it to the higher level. The lab would need to test all 15 of those to ensure that each one of those was the prohibited substance. But if they had less than that amount, then if I'm understanding it correctly, if they had less than that amount, they didn't possess 15 or more tablets, then it would be below the threshold, and they wouldn't necessarily test every tablet.
I guess it surprises me, Mr. Chair, because I would think a defense attorney would say, I mean, I'm not a lawyer or anything, but they would say, if you didn't test them all, then how would you know that you had that quantity? So I'm assuming you already test the full quantities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Through the chair, I think maybe Department of Law might have to explain that a little bit of how that works and why we do that.
Any other? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you tell me approximately how many people are serving under a Class C felony conviction currently in Alaska for drug possession?
Possession only or possession and other activities? That's been one.
Well, I guess I would possession only. Yeah.
And through the chair, Representative, I think Deputy Commissioner Taylor might be best to answer that. I bet you he has the numbers on him.
And Mr. Taylor, why don't you step up and answer that right now? Just I know you weren't up to testify, but since you're here, we'll get that on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ron Taylor. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And through the chair to Representative Munoz, it's about 427, but those are not exclusive to just the mixed four. They will also have some other offenses included in that as well. So.
We've had this discussion of how many trying to ferret it down is, and the numbers we've heard is under 100. Is that correct?
A couple of hundred if it's yes, that's true, Mr. Chair. Under 100 if it's just exclusively that, but it's harder for us to ferret out.
That was the representative's question, how many?
And as a follow-up, of those approximate 100, how long is this sentence, the average sentence?
And that's difficult to tease out in terms of the actual number. We just have the average length of stay for the entire 427, which is 188. Okay.
That was one of the questions I had because there's the war on drugs warehousing. The number, the high end, was 93 late last fall. And there's probably extenuating circumstances on those 93 because our system just doesn't have the capacity to put people in for just a simple possession. But that's something Law can talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for clarifying this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vaybrook, you can assume your position again. Mr. Vaybrook,
thank you.
Any other questions? I guess we brought you up prematurely. We'll go to the Department of Law now.
Thank you.
Welcome to another wing of our administrative justice team. Familiar faces. This may be the last bill we get to work on, the last set of bills. I suspect it will, unless you're going to come in as an interested citizen.
Well, I don't know, but I will say that Jim Pound over in House Judiciary says that being a short timer in the military gives you permission to be a pain in the neck. I'll try that to be. Mr. Chairman, my name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and this is my boss, Mr. Savadny, and he is he's director of the Criminal Division, Deputy Attorney General, and he's here to answer all the hard questions.
She does have a short-term syndrome.
And however you two want to coordinate this, we'll just listen.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this is Rick Savadny. If you will, I'd first ask Annie to go. She's the person who knows the nuts and the bolts of this bill, and then I'll make some general comments and certainly be willing to answer questions. I look forward to answering the question about how many people are incarcerated for.
We're going to go for about 20 more minutes because we have House Bill 160 before us, and this is not the last visit for this bill. And so, please,
Mr. Chairman, we are not opposing the bill, but we have concerns about it, and three really significant ones. Our first concern is that reducing possession of these really serious drugs sends the wrong message to children and youth in our state that they are not as serious as they really are. I don't believe I even need to say, because it's so much in the news these days, about the danger of heroin and its growth and its inexpensive. The cost is so much lower, and it's such a dangerous substance. And others are on these schedules, too. Our second concern is we really remain concerned about the supervision of people who are convicted of misdemeanors and then are released, because we don't have probation supervision for misdemeanors like we do for felons. And Mr. Kopp is correct. They added a provision allowing for supervision by an ASAP program for people who are convicted of fifth-degree possession of these serious crimes, possession would be if the bill were passed. ASAP supervision is not the same as Department of Correction supervision for probationers. It's an office-based program. I spoke to Mr. Tony Piper about it. Their probation officers are office-based. If they hear about a violation of a condition, they send a letter to the judge, and that is very different from what Department of Corrections probation officers do, which is much more active hands-on supervision of a person. And people with addictions need serious supervision if there's a hope that they can overcome their addictions. The last concern I'd like to mention at this point is treatment opportunities. The bill does not increase treatment opportunities. People who are released under these circumstances need housing. They need help to try and avoid becoming going back to their life that got them into trouble in the first place. They need housing. They need rehabilitation. And this bill does not increase that for people in these circumstances. And those are our concerns with the bill in its current form.
Mr. Savatni.
Thank you. Do I look like I'm blinking amber? This is Rick Sabodny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I frankly would like my job to go away. My goal in life is we get rid of people who we deal with society in a way that we reduce the number of crimes, and so we don't have to have prosecutors anymore. Unfortunately, I don't think this bill goes necessarily in that direction. Untreated drug users of the types of drugs that are covered in this bill, methamphetamine, heroin, LSD, are a danger to themselves, and we have to deal with that. They're a danger to their families, and they present a public safety danger to the rest of society. A month ago, did a survey of the DA's offices across the state at the request of the other body about the trends in drugs in urban areas. So where did I start? Bethel, right? Bethel, I thought I would get a base by going outside the urban areas, and I asked what the trends were in drug use. And the first thing that was said to me by the DA there is heroin. Heroin's a big problem. It's hit the bush. When I asked every other DA's office what the trend was, it was black tar heroin in their communities. All the urban areas said that there has been a reduction, or they don't see hardly ever anymore. Cocaine, the use of prescription medication is substantially decreasing because some people suing the manufacturers over the potency of some of those drugs. The manufacturers taking it upon themselves to make things like Oxycontin, oxycodone time released, and that's caused people, those reductions in those drugs have caused people to go to the cheaper heroin, and heroin is a real problem in this state and in the country. I mean, nationally, you may have heard that the governor of Vermont in his State of the State address this year to the legislature spoke exclusively about the heroin problem in that state. That was the entire State of the State. So we need to deal with this problem. And Senator Dyson has focused us as clearly as can be on what we do with people who are using drugs. And I applaud him for doing that. But I do have concerns when we take the situations like we had, and I know we didn't want to hear about things from the paper, but in the last 10 days, two instances in Anchorage, drug deal gone bad, shooting, 13-year-old girl dead. There are two parts to that drug deal, the distributor and the user. Yesterday's paper, a guy out on electronic monitoring, heading back to where he was supposed to be, also in a drug deal. He's a user, right? He didn't like what happened, so goes back to where he was living, gets a knife, and goes back and stabs the drug dealer. Reducing these crimes to misdemeanors are not going to solve the ancillary crimes that are being committed by these people. When I was doing the survey, I asked the Juneau District Attorney's Office, what other problems are there with drugs? And he said, well, burglary and NSF checks. He said, and he described to me a woman who opened a bank account and within a few weeks spent $15,000 in NSF checks to pay for her drug habit. He said virtually all burglaries in this community is to get things to sell so you have cash for either alcohol or drugs. So it is a problem that we need to deal with, but I don't know that reducing felonies, this type of, I don't think you should just look at it as a person who abuses a drug. That abuse has all these other consequences that go with it. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer Representative Mignot's question. She asked it in an interesting way, or maybe I misheard it in an interesting way. She asked how many people were incarcerated for B felonies for drug cases. That would be distribution. That's the drug dealer. And I don't know that you got the answer as far as drug dealers. It may be that there were 427, but I asked a different question. I asked the question, how many people are incarcerated for misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree, a C felony, that is the possession, the heroin possession, the LSD possession, the methamphetamine possession that this bill would reduce from a felony to a misdemeanor. And bear with me, because the answer was interesting. 44 to 124. Now, that was on October 1st, 2013. Now, the reason they can't tell me what that number is between 44 and 124 is because you have to go and research every file, because at least half of the people in that group were there for other offenses. That is, they were there not because they were got convicted of a drug offense, but they got charged with, and primarily, according to the Department of Corrections, felony assault level crimes. Secondarily, theft crimes. It said theft in the second degree, which would be a felony, but let's just say any theft crime, or a probation revocation. So I suggest to you that the police aren't going out and doing reverse buys. We have told police we aren't going to prosecute anybody where the police went out and sold me a gram of heroin for my use and then bust me because I'm possessing a gram of heroin. They aren't doing that. I have not seen a case. Actually, what we tell them is they need the Deputy Attorney General's approval to do a case like that. And sometimes when we're talking about pounds and stuff, we might do that, but we know that that person's a dealer. So people are getting arrested for these possession offenses because other criminal activity is going on. A good friend of mine, Sheriff Colander, who was for, I think, 3 decades, the sheriff in San Diego County, the second largest jail institution in the state of California, every quarter tested on one day each quarter everybody who came into his jail. And in for over a period of 10 years, it was in the 90th percentile, the number of people who came to jail that day having ingested some type of controlled substances. So, part of my concern, or our concern about this bill, is that it is not what you envision. It's not may envision. It's not somebody at home who bought some cocaine to snort that night. We aren't getting those people. We don't see those people. It's the people who are burglarizing a house and they get arrested by the police who have a gram or have methamphetamine in their pocket, things like that. Let me end by just saying what's really critical is that we deal with these people who are causing these other types of crime, and we can deal with them by housing them in jail. And I'm with Senator Dyson. We don't want to do that. It costs us. If there's another cheaper way of protecting society, it costs us too much money. We need to deal with them by stopping the behavior that's causing the criminal activity. And although this bill requires an assessment by Health and Social Services, it doesn't fund paying for that assessment. It doesn't fund anybody for doing drug testing for these people. It doesn't fund a halfway house or a residential treatment program if that's needed. All we're doing is we're saying it's going to be less likely. And let me circle back on that. I'm not saying that in the felony system they get those things, but they're sure a lot more likely to. They're going to have a felony probation officer. That felony probation officer is going to require reporting. They're going to be looking for symptoms of drug use. They may do random searches at the person's house. They will do drug testing. And we give up all those things in the kind of the treatment milieu, or if we moved the supervision of people convicted of drug offenses from felonies to misdemeanors. I hope I answered Representative Mignot's question.
Mr. Sabatini, Department of Public Safety threw out a kernel of an idea about maybe I don't think they called it a free pass, but on that first possession of offense, and then afterwards, is that a direction that that you might be able to support? It's not a free pass; it's still a misdemeanor, and in a lot of circumstances, you say you're not going to charge them for anything with that. So,
Mr. Chair. The answer to that question is yes. I mean, I sound like I'm hesitating, and I am, because I had this other thought that's slipped my mind since I started this. It's something that certainly makes doing the, why I was hesitating is, I don't think that if this bill passes as it's written, the sky is going to fall in. I don't believe that, and don't want to leave you with that impression. Everybody in the criminal justice system will deal with it. If it is a way to give a free pass, as you say,
and that's a mischaracterization. I'd like to take that off the record. It's a reduced sanction.
I understand
but
that.
But the reason I use it is you basically said you're giving those folks a pass by not even prosecuting them.
By not catching them.
If the police have initiated the sale, you said you'll send them. You'll send the case packing.
Yes, that will do.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm 64. I grew up in New York City. I came to Fairbanks in 1969. When I was a kid, you could buy drugs everywhere. In the schoolyard, I came to Fairbanks, same thing. It's getting worse. In the past 50 years, what drug policy has worked? Children are cynical. Immediately, as soon as they hit the teenage years, they become cynical of the drug policy. We lose them right away. You know, we have a policy of cracking down harder and harder and harder all these years. That doesn't seem to have deterred anything. I'm delighted that Senator Dyson has come back with something that seems it's counterintuitive. But I'm just wondering, what have we been able to accomplish in 50 years except increasing the penalties and the fines we're looking at a huge social fiscal crunch. I know that we've heard the story many times of the Texas Senate president assigning somebody to go out and find out how we don't have to build more prisons. And I think this is part of that focus of how we don't have to do that anymore. But in all these years, I mean, you guys are on the front lines. What has worked in all these years? Is there anything out there that has worked?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, Jerry Madden, the person from Texas, mm-hmm. I think has it right, but what he says is, if you aren't putting the person, don't put the person in this building with bars, put them in a treatment program. And our commissioner of corrections can do that. I mean, we have people on home serving their jail times in homes, at their house, or. With electronic monitoring, we can do that. You asked me what works. I think some of the things that Representative Madden talked about do work, but this bill is only half of it. Don't put them in jail. It doesn't deal with the other half. Now, that's talking about this bill, and you asked me what works, and I'm depressed about that. I don't know that. Maybe I need something.
A lot of low-hanging fruit we don't have. They were incarcerating people for marijuana possession, a lot of things that we wouldn't have ever, our system would have never dreamed of putting people in behind bars for. I mean, it just through process-wise. So the Madden example is, although a success in Texas, doesn't necessarily translate. And Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Mr. Savatny. And I think I've said everything that you've said many times in my office. We've tasked ourselves this year with an amendment in the operating budget to try and do what we can and work with corrections and public safety to get more into the treatment, because the bottom line is I think, and my sense is your sense, is that it's an addiction, and you have to treat the addiction, and these people are very transient, so they move around a lot. They tend to wear out their welcome. That's life on the street. Is it working where, in your opinion, people tend to get low-level sentencing before they're able to get a drug treatment program in corrections, which is 75 to 90 days before they get them, according to discussions that I've had with the commissioner, that they don't have time to pursue and get that drug treatment program? They get let out on a condition of parole. Some of those conditions of parole would be go to a drug treatment program, but they have to help pay for that, and they don't have a job because they're a felon. So they have to rob from you and I to go pay for them so that they don't get thrown back in jail. Is that do you see a trend like that also?
After they choose to rob.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the reason I'm hesitating here is I could have answered that question a lot better 10 years ago when I was the DA, and I was dealing with that on a daily basis. I don't want to be suggesting that longer jail sentences are the way to deal with this. I mean, if you have somebody who's addicted, and that's the issue, we shouldn't be putting that person in jail. We should be treating that addiction. The problem is that those people who are addicted are burglarizing people's houses so they can keep paying for their addiction. They are also, if you ask my opinion, they're also distributors. I mean, but they're low. They aren't the people you think of. They aren't some cartel. They'll get, you know, maybe have enough money for five hits of heroin and, you know, sell three, buy five, and then sell three to the other people that they know are addicted. And that's where we may catch them. And this bill doesn't deal with that. I mean, we need to have a program where people who are addicted to drugs are supervised. And you know, I think the jail is the last line of that type of supervision. They need to be in the treatment program before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to come back to this topic later. We have Representative Thompson's bill to deal with. We went a little bit over the allotment time, but not by much. So we will have this back before us. I won't say in less than 10 days because that's obvious. hopefully a. I mean, I'm trying to slot some time. We have some gas line stuff that's already slated with the minority's legal team for our consultant, and we have some things that we can't alter. So we will get this. We're dealing on the 24-hour rule. We will get this in the queue along with the other crime bill and the gas line and the capital budget and a few other bills. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I know we didn't have courts, but could I just put a question out there for them they could bring back to us?
Yeah, please.
I would be very curious how many people we have right now, misdemeanors that we have in jails, and the time it takes for them to get their trial date, and how much of this problem of our courts, of our jails filling up, is because of the courts being backed up versus needing to change felonies and misdemeanors. So I just figured I wanted to put that out there, and I'll touch base with them as well to clarify.
Yeah, if you can probably clarify that directly. Ms. Mead will make the time to meet with you personally. We'll have this bill back before us. Thank you, Senator Dyson. We'll have you back as well, and we'll have the public testimony portion as well. We are working on the fly, though, with our schedule here. But Representative Thompson, you're up next. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you all soon. The bill we have before us is House Bill 160.
Can I
Healing from the original version, Representative Thompson?
Yes, / O.
Very good. We're in order.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is Steve Thompson. I House representative from House District 3 up in Fairbanks. For us today, we have House Bill number 160, an act relating to the licensing and regulation of athletic trainers. House Bill 160 would amend current statutes to establish licensing and regulations of athletic trainers in the state of Alaska. Athletic trainers are health care professionals who collaborate with physicians to enhance the practice of sports medicine for patients and clients. The profession plays a significant role in the management, prevention, recognition, and rehabilitation of injured athletes under the supervision of a licensed physician. Athletic trainers are a vital resource in administering injury prevention and treatment programs, as well as immediate emergency care for the sport and athletic community. Alaska is one of the final two states that doesn't currently license athletic trainers. House Bill 160 will require athletic trainers to have a license to practice in the state of Alaska. House Bill 160 will hold athletic trainers accountable to the rigorous standards of the Board of Certification, INC, a national agency created to certify healthcare professionals and assure the protection of the public. As Alaskans become increasingly more active, the need for properly trained and licensed athletic trainers becomes imperative. So I ask for your support on House Bill 160, and with me today is my staff, Brody Anderson, who can run you through the bill and explain it in a little bit more in depth.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. I'll briefly walk through the sectional, going through each one of the sections for the committee members. Section 1 adds a whole new chapter for athletic trainers. In Section 080710, are the license requirements in, and then also the qualifications, fee, and renewal for in 0872 or 20, excuse me, are the qualifications. In 087030 are the scope of practice of an athletic trainer. And then we also add a new section, 0807040, in which defines the regulations and how they'll be drafted. 0807040 includes definitions. In section 3, AS0965300, which is the immunity for providing free health care services, athletic trainer is added to health care providers. Section 4, AS4717290, amends the section to add athletic trainers to practitioner of healing arts. And then finally, Section 5 is uncodified law, which is the applicability of the bill. And that's the brief sections.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to have a discussion on the record here with the sponsor of something that we talked about off the record. The only concerns I've heard about this bill are from people who are not athletic trainers, but are coaches or fitness consultants or personal trainers, and they're worried that this bill would somehow put them make what they're doing illegal. Could you address? I believe in conversations with your office, with the athletic trainers, and also in some communications I think we have in our packet from the Department of Commerce and from Legislative Legal, it sounds like that's not the case. The people who are doing personal training or coaching adults would not fall under this bill. Could you address those concerns?
Through the chair, in your packet you have a Wednesday, April 9, 2014 memo from Sarah Chambers from the Division of Licensing, and she does go through and explain that there is not current licensed in this title that perform functions that are identified as athletic training or in the scope of the professional duties, example, physical training coaches. They do address that. If you want me to go through this, or do you want to take a chance or time to read?
Representative Holmes wanted some things on the record. Is that your intention?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just because there were some concerns from the general public, and I think those concerns are addressed in these documents. I just want to make sure.
And I want to make sure my staff, that there was a letter we got late last night from Peak Fitness, Ms. McKee and Palmer. I don't see it in mine. I want to make sure we promise. It is. Okay, maybe it's just mine. And that's a similar concern raised.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Anderson can probably do better than me reading this to you. He's memorized it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have in the audience as well Sarah Chambers, the Director of Licensing, who drafted the memo, and she might be able to talk about how they will tackle this issue. The most important two things, I believe, for defining the differences between coaches and fitness trainers and then what athletic trainers will do is answered in question 2 and 3, which is there's two criteria that need to be met in order to be classified as an athletic trainer. One that's under the direction of a physician, so that's one criteria, and then you also have to use the title athletic trainer. So if you're doing one of those two things, using the title athletic trainer or operating in the scope of what is defined as an athletic trainer under the supervision of a physician, then you would be classified as an athletic trainer and need to be licensed.
Follow up, just to be absolutely clear, and I would love it if Ms. Chambers could just put that, some of that on the record really quickly. But yeah, I think I'm pretty satisfied with the answers that that as long as they're not calling themselves athletic trainers or any of the short list of things that are in the bill, and as long as they're not actually purporting to, you know, actually working under a physician or a nurse and doing things that your personal trainer at the gym, your person who's out coaching a softball team, obviously they're trying to help prevent injury, obviously they're trying to make sure that people are safe, and obviously they're going to be referring people hopefully to healthcare providers when necessary, but that simply doing the things I just described would not put them sideways with this bill.
Ms. Chambers, why don't you just put this on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Yes, our understanding and interpretation of the bill is that if one of those two criteria are met, then licensure would be required. That if one is working under the scope as defined of athletic training, which would include or require direction under a supervision of a physician, and then the other element would be someone who simply calls themselves an athletic trainer would require to be licensed. We call that title protection. So you would have to, only people who were licensed could use that or a list of similar related titles that are included in the language of the bill. So a coach who was calling him or herself a coach, a personal trainer who was calling him or herself a personal trainer and not an athletic trainer, and who was not working under in a medical capacity under a physician but was simply there to render, you know, first responder type of first aid, much as a parent or a Good Samaritan might, would not require an athletic trainer license.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, for instance, let's say that I had an injury. I don't live in Fairbanks, but I went to a doctor in Fairbanks, and I lived in a small community. And so I went back. I had, you know, my doctor called maybe the health clinic in my area that doesn't have an athletic trainer and asked to do certain types of therapy so that I can get back on my feet. My understanding on this bill, that person could not do that because they would now be an athletic trainer. Is that correct?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, if one already holds a medical license that would include the types of activities that that you would require as a patient, then that's already covered under the scope of their license and is articulated in the bill that they would not require an additional license in order to get that type of medical care. So a physician, a nurse, a nurse's aide, physical therapist, if they're performing within the scope of their license the care that you might need, then additional licensure is not needed.
Okay, so follow up. Okay, so I'm a coach. Okay, so the basketball. entry. So I go back to my small school. I'm supposed to be able to, you know, do certain kinds of what a personal trainer would do, but my coach is going to do it. I'm not licensed in any of that, but that's what the physician said that child needed. Would that coach be okay to do that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, my interpretation and my understanding of the bill is that if the coach is working under the supervision of a medical doctor in that capacity, if the coach, him or herself, is working under that supervision, then they would require an athletic trainer license because they're working within the scope of a medical athletic trainer. However, the patient, if the patient has received care and they're such as a return to play protocol that they're working on themselves and the coach is not working under that medical supervision, then the onus of making sure that you get proper medical care is on the patient and not on the coach. That's a little bit of a shade of gray, and that's my understanding. Certainly that's a question that might be best ferreted out by legal, but the bottom line of my understanding is that the coach isn't working under the supervision of a physician, then they're not operating as an athletic trainer unless they call themselves as such.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm following up on Representative Wilson's. It seems like the key here, because you know, it's pretty clear if you're calling yourself an athletic trainer, that's pretty black and white. The I guess where we're getting hung up a little bit here is the definition of working under the supervision. I mean, if I'm injured and I go to a doctor and they say, here's what you need to be doing, and I go back and I tell my coach of my sporting team what I'm supposed to be doing, or I tell my physical trainer or my personal trainer, that they're not working under the supervision of the doctor. So what does it mean to be working under the supervision of the person? I mean, that it sounds like it's a more formal thing than just helping the athlete. I mean, working under the supervision seems like a much more formal relationship than just simply taking the recommendations of the doctor and helping the person implement. Is that
through the chair, right? Representative Holmes, we do have Lynn Young, who is the.
I'm hoping to get to her.
Yeah, we have Lynn Young, who is the vice president of the Alaska Association of Athletic Trainers, here to speak directly about the duties, responsibility, and scope of practice for athletic trainers. And I believe online we have Dr. Keller, who is a sports medicine physician, and he can talk about that relationship as well.
We have a Dr. Jill Valerius.
Okay,
from the Valley.
Chair, could I just point to a typo that I asked them to get fixed?
We'll note it, please.
Thank you. Just to the sponsor, a license is required on page one. If you're a student, you're licensed, you have military service, but there's no and or, so we don't know if you have to meet all three of those conditions or one of those conditions there.
And or, isn't it?
So. On page, starting on page 1, line 10, going through page 2, line 4, unless I missed it, in which case I'm wrong.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I believe it is or, and I will make sure of that and get back to the committee. Thank you.
Representative Osterman, then we're going to go to our two witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the department. Sarah, and I look at the fifth note, and it's $48,000, and then I read the description in the back on page 2, and it talks about what those costs would entail, and it appears to me that the $48,000 is to set up the program and put it all in place and get it going. My question then is if there's what's the cost going to be for an ongoing program, and how much will you have to charge a fee to these? I think there's approximately 40 people involved in this. So what will each one of those 40 members have to pay on a yearly basis to keep the program going?
Representative Osterman, through the chair, that is my quest in front of you this session, is to make those clarifications. Working with an estimate of We had an estimate of 60 licensees, and looking at that first year of setup and then an approximate cost of about $26,000 going out, we were estimating anywhere between $110 and $180 for licensing fees. Certainly the higher end of licensing fees would be to help cover those larger initial setup costs, and then as those costs were covered and then the expenses were lowered, the licensing fee would be adjusted downward. So again, just to make sure that everyone is aware that those are estimates, that the actual activity of the program will dictate the fee according to AS 0801065. We did base the estimate on, as we have attempted to do for illustrative purposes, on the naturopath licensing program, which has a similar number of licensees, and it has no board, so those costs are not included. And if you have the if you're looking at naturopath, the naturopath program, they had some significant legal expenses in the last couple of fiscal years, which were not included in this estimate because they were not considered to be comparable to what athletic trainers would experience.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to invite Ms. Young up. Sorry. Hope we're not rushing you too much. Great to see you out of the venue of a ball game.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And for the record, my name is Lynn Young, and I am not the vice president. I am the secretary treasurer of the athletic, Alaska Athletic Trainers Association, in addition to the governmental affairs chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 160. And I'd like to address a couple of the concerns that were brought up specifically. But to begin, athletic trainers are highly qualified, educated, and multi-skilled healthcare professionals, as Representative Thompson stated. We do collaborate with and work under the direction of physicians. Some of our care consists of prevention, emergency care, clinical assessment, therapeutic intervention, and rehabilitations of injuries and medical conditions. To clarify one point, simply by working under the direction of a physician and calling themselves an athletic trainer does not require a license. There is a lot of crossover. And the big defining portion is what our education consists of. To become an athletic trainer, you must attend an accredited athletic training curriculum, a four-year bachelor's degree. Once you successfully pass that, then you're eligible to sit for a Board of Certification national exam. It's pretty rigorous, and it consists of three components. Once you pass that exam, then you can hold the credentials of a certified athletic trainer. We have one board of certification nationally recognized. It's called the BOC Inc., which means that we don't need a separate state board, which will defeat, you know, a lot of the cost as well. They govern our practical standards, our professional requirements, and our continuing education. Once we pass that national exam, and we can call ourselves certified athletic trainer, it doesn't stop there. We must continue to maintain continuing education units. We have to have minimally 50 every 2 years, as approved by the Board of Certification, 10 hours of which have to be evidence-based. In addition, we have to maintain currency emergency cardiac care at the professional medical rescuer level or above. And this is ongoing. After we've met those standards, then we are certified and we can operate. Alaska is one of only two states that currently does not regulate athletic training. We are being proactive in order to ensure that those individuals that are taking care of the public and our kids on the sidelines, and the Chinooks baseball team, of course, actually can are athletic trainers and hold the minimal standards set forth by our Board of Certification. It does not prevent somebody else from working in the capacity that they are trained. For example, a physician assistant works under the direction and supervision of a physician. They do not attend a four-year athletic training curriculum. They do similar things that athletic trainers do. They do injury eval and, you know, a broader scope as well. But they do not call themselves athletic trainers. a certified nurse assistant that works in many of our small villages here in Alaska. They work under the direction, supervision of a physician. They do injury assessment. They do injury prevention and wellness care. They are not calling themselves an athletic trainer, and they have not gone to a four-year accredited curriculum. So therefore, they are working under the capacity of a certified nurse assistant or as a physician assistant. A coach by the state, Alaska State Activities Association, is required to attend a fundamental coaching class in addition to a sports injury course, in addition to now, because of House Bill 15, which athletic trainers fully supported and helped pass a concussion law, they also are required to take a free 20-minute online concussion awareness course. We hope that if somebody does get injured on the sidelines, first of all, we hope the coaches can prevent injuries, as it makes our job easier and it prevents kids and individuals from being hurt. But should an injury be sustained, which is the nature of, unfortunately, athletics, job security, whatever you want to call it, people, you know, go through rigorous activities, there is the nature that they may get hurt. We hope that they can assess that as far as, okay, you know what, your ankle hurts, come over to the sideline and give them a bag of ice, or what that sports injury class, that basic first aid, has taught them. And they are operating as a concerned coach. They are certainly not saying, I'm an athletic trainer, let me put this ice bag on you, which that's one portion. We do a lot more than just put ice bags on. But they are working under that study. In addition to a fitness trainer, well-skilled professionals that help with fitness and wellness. And in fact, I went to one when I did my first triathlon in December. Very skilled. However, they're working as a fitness trainer in that capacity. So if they are educating somebody on decreasing injuries, if they are acknowledging that their clients may have pulled a muscle or an injury, they are operating under that license. This bill, House Bill 160, by no means is trying to regulate other professions, is not causing people to lose their jobs or have to get licensed. This is simply our proactive nature to regulate the individuals in the state that are calling themselves athletic trainers. On behalf of the Athletic Association, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I respectfully ask for you to support this and move it out of committee.
I know are you going to be in town for the rest of the day, or what's your schedule?
I can be.
Well, we don't want to hold you necessarily, but it's our intent to try to we have a couple, and I want to hear from Dr. Valerius in the remaining minutes we have. I'd like to bring this up this evening at 6 o'clock after our afternoon session. So I'm going to go to Dr. Valerius. You can sit there. Dr. Valerius in Wasilla. I hope you didn't have to leave.
Hi, this is Joe Valeria. Can you guys hear me?
Loud and clear.
You're able to hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. Thank you. For the record, this is Joe Valeria. I'm a physician and a certified athletic trainer in Wasilla. I've been an athletic trainer for over 20 years, and I've been a physician for, I think maybe 16 years now. I think that it's imperative that we get this bill passed, and there's a couple of reasons being. Number one, it protects the public. And I think this, I hear this debate about the working under a doctor and the concern that it's going to impact what other people are doing. And I think, and if I'm hearing this right and understand this correctly, and I think the big thing is what this defines is who is an athletic trainer and who can call themselves athletic trainers in our state. And as Lynn brought up, and I don't remember if somebody else did, you know, we're one of two states in the United States that does not have a licensure. So what it does is ensures that whoever's calling themselves as a certified athletic trainer is indeed trained and certified, working in under a collaborative agreement with a physician. And basically, they know what they're doing, so we can be assured of the safety and the quality of care that we're providing, you know, to the extent that we can do that through any licensure program. So I think from a public safety standpoint, it's great. I think also from an athletic trainer standpoint, as certified athletic trainers, we work really hard to get where we are, and to have a personal trainer or someone else call themselves an athletic trainer, that's slighting to anybody. You know, for me, that's the same thing as a nurse practitioner or a PA calling themselves a doctor. You know, I went to a lot more school, and, you know, my differential diagnosis and that stuff, I hope, is larger than them. And it's not to diminish what they do at all. I think there's a lot of different great providers out there, but we are providers for whatever it is we trained in. And I think that's the important thing. So protection of the public, protection of the certified athletic trainers. My concern that we're only one of two states in the United States that do not have an Athletic Training Licensure Act. I think that that's really important. Remembering that athletic trainers, similar to physician assistants, always work in a collaborative agreement with a physician. So athletic trainers always have that backup as well. And it's not to diminish. I understand in this state, I came from Minnesota, where almost every state or every high school in the state has an athletic trainer, so I came from a different place and practiced as an athletic trainer there. But I understand our difference here and our regional accessibility and that kind of stuff. And it is not to diminish what anyone else is doing right now. It's just to say that you can't call yourself an athletic trainer. You can call yourself a personal trainer. You can call yourself a coach. You can call yourself a CNA, a community health aide. Those things are all fine, and as long as we each act under our own licensure and our own regulations, I think that's what's appropriate. And so the bill is not trying to impact what other people are doing, other than don't call yourself an athletic trainer, because it sometimes can make us look bad if somebody calls themselves an athletic trainer. They're not an athletic trainer, and something isn't done the way that we would do that, which I think anybody in a profession can appreciate that sense. So I'm really hopeful that we can get this through, this legislation. This is our second year trying to get this through, and I really appreciate your time and the opportunity to be able to speak to you today. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other public testimony? We have already discussed the fiscal. First, are there any amendments?
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Wilson.
I have an amendment.
If you have amendments, then we're going to wait till tonight. And Representative Wilson would like the bill delayed till tonight. We will deal with it tonight. We will stand in adjournment.
Okay.